My name is Dr. Chris Jenkins, and I am the CEO of the Orianne Society and the host of the Snake Talk podcast, the podcast where you learn about nature's most feared, maligned, and persecuted animals. I invite you to listen to this conversation, and maybe you'll find that what you perceive as fear is actually rooted in a deep fascination. We are live. Welcome to the Snake Talk podcast. I am here with Julia Dean. She is a journalist and a writer, and she's written a fascinating book on snake handlers and snake handling churches. And we're going to have an in-depth conversation today about that book and about those churches and people more generally. And I will say, just to kick it off, it's always been the concept of these snake handling churches has always been really fascinating to me, and really from the perspective of just the core of how humans feel around snakes. And so, I've talked many times on this podcast and other places that one of the things that really gets me excited and one of the things that really gets my adrenaline going and one of the things I enjoy is to handle snakes. It's just it's a thrilling event for me. It would be like, someone enjoys going skiing or something like that. When I handle a snake, it really gives me, just quite an adrenaline rush that some might say I'm addicted to, but I do enjoy it. And the other thing I'll say is I've watched some of the videos online in preparation for this recording, this podcast. I've watched videos of a number of snake handlers in church, and also watched some of them kind of out in the field collecting the snakes that they're going to use. It was fascinating to me because there were real parallels. I could just see in their body language and how they were acting that I believe that they have a very similar thing in some ways to me, that they actually enjoy interacting with the snake. They actually enjoy catching the snake and handling the snake. So we won't get too deep into that psychology, but we may touch on that a little bit later. So, well, Julia, welcome to the podcast. It is quite an honor to have you here with us.
Thank you, Chris.
No problem. And before we get too deep into the book and the concept of snake handling, why don't you just take a minute and introduce yourself to our audience and really, kind of what is it? We'll walk back through kind of some of your history that led you to writing this book, but why don't you walk through, kind of what you're doing today, where you're living and what your, primary kind of career is at this point?
Right now, I'm based out of Seattle, and I haven't been back to Appalachia since 2017. But there was a time when I was living fairly close. I was in West Tennessee. I was a college professor at a Baptist university. And before that, I was in the Washington, D.C. area working for a couple newspapers. I've been in reporting and journalism for about 40 years, and it's my curiosity about different kinds of religions that really got me involved in this. And I'm still reporting on religion. I'm still doing pieces on it. And I am doing a piece actually for National Geographic as we speak that is like a follow-up on my book and what's going on with serpent handlers now. By the way, just one thing. Sometimes I use snake handlers. Sometimes I use serpent handlers. The folks who do this sort of thing, they like to use the biblical word serpent. And so sometimes I'll slip into their terminology just to warn you.
No, that's great. And serpent is certainly a word we use in the science and conservation management world here. So I think all of our listeners will know exactly what you're talking about. So it's kind of an interesting topic to really dive into. And so I'm glad to have somebody who's thought this deeply and done this much research on the topic. But before we get to some of that, well, let me back up and say, so in your current, you know, life and career, are you primarily freelance then, or are you working for a particular publication?
Right. I'm freelance right now. Right. In that I've worked for various newspapers, Houston Chronicle, Washington Times, and then I went into teaching college journalism for a time. And then I had to move back to Seattle for family reasons. And so, yeah, it's mostly back all freelance writing at this point.
Great. Okay. Well, so how was it, you know, before we even talk about getting to, you know, the serpent handlers, what was it that drew you to journalism, you know, reporting and writing in general? Is this something you always wanted to do with your life, or is this something that kind of came to you later in life?
I've always wanted to do it. I've always been a writer. And I started winning some writing contests. I was on my student newspaper in eighth grade. And in high school and in college, I was an English major because I wanted to do liberal arts and study in different parts of the world. But yeah, I've loved to write. And I also like to ask questions, which has gotten me into lots of trouble. But you have to have a real curiosity about just anything. And my first newspaper in Clackamas County, Oregon, which is just south of Portland, I was asked if I could do either the ag page, agriculture, or I had to edit the religion page. I chose the religion page. So I got into religion reporting as kind of a side thing. And it wasn't until I went to the Houston Chronicle that I covered religion full time. But the one thing I never covered, because I've covered just about everything, been to Rome to cover the papal transition, been to India, been to seeing apparitions of the Virgin Mary in Yugoslavia. But one thing I'd never gone to was a snake handling church, because most of it, reporters just consider that as sort of like the dregs of journalism, covering these crazy people in West Virginia somewhere. And that's about all I knew about them until 2011.
And so I did want to talk about the religion. So, you know, what I had assumed is you kind of had this big interest in journalism, and then you also had this interest in religion, and you found a way to kind of get those to overlap and build a career around that. But it sounds like your primary interest was in journalism, and then you know, it was just circumstance and opportunity that led you into kind of first getting a foot in the door with religion reporting, and then that really turned into your primary job. Is that kind of how you would describe it, or did you also have this very strong parallel interest in religion?
Oh, I had a parallel interest in religion too, very much so. I mean, I'd become a born-again Christian when I was 16, and I felt, as I read the religion sections, at the time I was living in Seattle, and I looked at what was in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the Oregonian, I thought the religion reporting stunk, and that the most reporters didn't understand what made people tick, and this was sort of during the time of the Jesus movement, and I just thought journalists weren't getting it. So when I started working for various newspapers, I would offer to take on the religion beat. And most editors are like, oh, great, you handle those crazy people who come in with church notices. And so, of course, then I started diversifying into the local Jewish community, when I was in Houston, covering Muslims. I was one of the first reporters to even cover Muslims. This is back in the 70s. This is way before 9/11, when it got fashionable. So, yeah, I mean, I had a personal interest. But again, a lot of people, most people in the newsroom didn't even want to touch it as a beat. So that's how I ended up specializing in it.
Yeah. And I really appreciated some of the articles that I read just preparing for this podcast, things that you've written or things that have been written about you or your book. I really appreciated that, you know, with these serpent handlers, it sounds like you were coming into researching this topic in a somewhat objective way, meaning you weren't coming in to really just kind of, you know, run these people down or do anything like that. You were going in to just trying to understand this culture, if you will, this aspect to you know, the religion. And I really appreciate that, because as a scientist, you know, I like to you know, think about topics like that. And certainly that's how I think about serpent handling as well, is I try to think of it in a somewhat objective way. Is that an accurate way to kind of describe how you kind of first approached the topic?
Sure. I mean, I didn't know what to think of these folks. And I mean, the way a lot of reporters think, like, oh, especially again, they're all in Appalachia. You think, oh, they're just all these inbred people who are just don't know any better and who haven't been beyond high school. And I found that the folks I was running into were smart, articulate people who'd been there, done that. A lot of them, not all, but a number of them had difficult backgrounds. They had been on drugs. They'd kind of been there, they'd tried a lot of stuff before they found God. And also, too, I mean, the serpent handlers were kind of a persecuted minority. Some people talked about how they were, if anybody knew that they did it, they'd lose their jobs. Their families would go after them. Even in Appalachia, it's not a real popular pastime. I mean, even the locals think you're crazy if you do it, if you go to a snake handling church.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's true. So so we're going to get to the book in a minute. But first, I want to talk kind of generally about serpent handling and serpent handling churches. And first of all, how did you, so you had these interests, you had an interest in religion and you had an interest in journalism, and then you were building, you know, you built your career, you know, on this religious beat, as you say. And then you mentioned, you know, you kind of always knew about this fringe group of people, and you know, you had heard all maybe the stereotypes or the generalizations about this group of people that's hiding out in the Appalachians, but how did you get from that point, you know, in your career to really deciding, I'm going to really dive deep and learn about these churches and learn about the people involved in it?
Well, it all started with a chance meeting with a photographer. And she and I were both doing some freelance work for the Washington Post. And she told me she was researching for a documentary of some sort, these people in Appalachia and why a lot of them were dying early, why the health conditions were so bad in southern West Virginia. But she was running into these serpent handlers, these people who took snakes into church, and she needed a reporter to work with her who had some theological background. And of course, I had a seminary degree, so I said, sure, I'll help her. And I was already doing religion reporting for the Washington Post. So I offered to go with her to a homecoming in a place called Jolo, West Virginia, which is a huge serpent handling center. And the Post offered to pay our way and put us up at a hotel, and they wanted the story. They didn't have a reporter who could take 5 days to do it. So we went. I took my six-year-old daughter with me and sat for 3 days in Jolo and did the article. And I really did not expect to really like the folks, but I got to like them a lot. And then the article came out. It didn't make a huge splash. It was mainly on one serpent handler, a guy called Mac Wolford. Then the photographer said, hey, I know about a 20-year-old pastor of a new serpent handling church. This is near Knoxville. Do you want to spend New Year's weekend visiting that? So we went and visited that. And he actually got snake bit on New Year's Eve, right at the stroke of midnight, of all things. And we talked to him the next day. We took him out to pizza for he didn't have anything major wrong with him. Fortunately, there was no venom in the bite, but it was a rattlesnake that bit him. So that was a little weird seeing him get bit. And so I thought, I've got to do something with this pastor story. I ended up selling it to the Wall Street Journal. It got truckloads of readership over Easter weekend, 2012. So I thought, whoa, there's interest in this. And then Mac Wolford, the person I profiled for the Post, ended up having a revival meeting on Memorial Day weekend of 2012. He got bit by a timber rattler and he died. And so that was of major interest to a lot of people. I think that was the most famous story of my entire career. It went everywhere because it went on the Post News Service. It went like even to Great Britain. I was getting calls from overseas. People wanted to interview me because there hadn't been a major serpent handling death in some time. So amazingly, I had just gotten a job offer to teach college journalism in West Tennessee. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to be kind of close to these folks. I moved to West Tennessee. I ended up visiting some of these churches again. And, you know, I got more and more interested. And as time went on, I began to just think, you know what? I wonder if these folks would be worth a book, because there hadn't been really a decent book written about them in a long time. And I had so many notes and I'd known the reaction to the newspaper articles I'd written on them. So I decided, let's go and see if we can possibly publish a book on this. So it was a long journey. It took about 2 years before I decided to actually do research. One other thing, I did end up in 2013 going for a second master's degree in journalism at the University of Memphis. And they lent their help in helping me do some qualitative research so I could actually, I had the backing of an educational institution as I tried to figure out what kind of people do handle serpents, or what kind of people at least are interested in this whole social media phenomenon. Because what made my research different is that I was tracking folks who were posting all their snake handling pictures and videos on social media. That's what was different from any of the other research that had been done before.
I love that story. So you got all this experience, you've got a whole career behind you of, you know, journalism and you know, it, with religion. And then there's this kind of this small offshoot group of people that, you know, you just kind of go to do one story about, and it takes your whole career on a different trajectory. That's great. That's how so many things happen in this world, isn't it? So
no kidding.
But so I want to get into the book, but I just want to talk about a couple real general things about these snake handling churches, just to orient some of the audience. So first of all, you mentioned Jolo and you mentioned West Virginia, and I just want to talk a little bit about the geography of this phenomenon first. It's primarily, you mentioned Appalachia, it's primarily in the Southeast, and it's, you know, primarily in Appalachia. So you mentioned West Virginia, you also mentioned, I think you mentioned Tennessee, East Tennessee. What's kind of the geographic area in which these serpent handling churches operate?
Western North Carolina, Northwestern Georgia, Northeastern Alabama, Kentucky, of course, Eastern Kentucky, Virginia, far Western Virginia. I think that's, and then of course, West Virginia. I think that's six states. And you get little bits of people in Indiana or Ohio who are involved, but it's basically the six Appalachian states.
Yeah. So that's fascinating to me, because there is a geography to it. I mean, it's limited to a particular place. And so to me, that links to there's a history there, and we don't need to go into too much depth, but I'd be curious just to talk about that a little bit. But first, you know, so these serpent handlers, could you just give the audience, like, what are they doing when we say serpent handling? Like, how would serpent handling in a general sense come into, you know, this religious event, you know, into preaching or whatever it might be? And then what's kind of the basis for that? I know there's really kind of one particular section of the Bible, but, you know, just curious if you could tell the audience a little bit about that.
The whole thing is based on an unusual reading of the King James Version of Mark 16, verses 17 and 18. That's in the New Testament. And there's these two verses say the following:
And these signs shall follow them that believe. In my name shall they cast out devils. They shall speak with new tongues. They shall take up serpents. And if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover. Okay, I think most Christians would say, well, what this really means is if you run into a snake and it bites you, then it won't hurt you, according to this. But there's a subset of Pentecostals. They call themselves signs following Pentecostals because the verse begins with, you know, these signs shall follow them. They feel the Bible mandates handling snakes in church, actually bringing a snake to church and passing it around. So what does this look like? Well, in a typical service, you'll see folks walk in with sort of, I'd say, these boxes. They're wooden boxes with glass tops. And they're about 2 feet long and maybe a foot wide. And of course, if you look into them, there's usually a snake or two curled up in them. And these are their snake boxes. They sell for about $75 each. There's people who have an actual industry in making them and they have scripture verses on the top of them. And so folks will take their snake boxes and put them sort of at the head of the church. Worship will start. And then people are, you know, worshiping, dancing. It's all, it's hard to describe the actual music, but it's kind of a, you know, sort of a soul rock, I call it kind of hillbilly music, which is not a great way to call it, but it's, you know, so it's guitars, it's piano, it's old
time. So it's live music. It's not necessarily
very live. Oh my gosh. Very live. Great. Everybody of course is dressed in what they call holiness style. Women have long hair, which is not cut, no makeup, and long skirts. Men will wear long sleeve shirts. They feel it's immodest to have short sleeves. Anyway, I could always tell when they were going to pick up the snakes or get them out of the boxes because it's usually the men. Women do handle, but it's sort of like 80% guys who are doing this. And I would notice there's like a front area where there's a podium and then there's a bunch of seats kind of in a circle in back of the podium / altar and like an altar rail. And then there's kind of like the rest of the congregation is like seated in pews, but it's this place in back of the podium, which is really where the action takes place. And I could always tell that the men would kind of gather around the snake boxes and you can just about count the seconds until all of a sudden someone reaches down, opens up a box and grabs a snake and they're holding it up in the air. Now, what most of them do is like they'll hold the snake kind of about a foot of the snake is sort of pointing upward because the snake is just trying to get some kind of equilibrium from what I can tell. And like about a foot down, they will be holding kind of the body of the snake, and then maybe with the other hand holding the rest of the snake kind of in a S-shaped curve. And again, the snake is usually weaving back and forth, trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. It can see, but as you know, it can't hear. Although, you know, the music is so loud that it might be listening to, it can kind of feel some of the beat. There are some of the handlers will not just hold the snake. They will actually put the snake around their necks, or they'll just grab a whole truckload of snakes, like four or five, like a bundle that looks like a whole spaghetti handful of snakes in their hands and kind of dance about while these, you know, different snake heads are bobbing back and forth. Every once in a while, and this is very rare, someone will put a snake on the floor and actually step on it. And because they want to show that our, you know, like God's mastery over the snake representing Satan and so on. And I mean, there's all sorts of things that go on. I've seen people take a snake and almost slap it across their shoulder, like a whip or something. And so usually that's a little unusual, but you see all sorts of things going on, but people are, you know, they're moving across the stage. They're handling snakes to other people and then taking them back. it's kind of like watching people, they don't throw them through the air, but they hand them. But it's like what they call free handling. It's very, I mean, there's no like gloves or sticks or anything protective against the snake.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. If you know, I've handled thousands and thousands of rattlesnakes. I don't freehand them, but I've handled them in various ways. And, you know, I would say that one of the most likely times that you would receive a snake bite from a venomous or a non-venomous snake would be when you first reach in that box or that cage to grab the animal. And so I'm curious, in the events that you've seen, when they first go for the snake, do they just reach in and grab them, or do they use like a hook and then pull the snake up and grab it? Because, for example, even with our non-venomous snakes here at my office, you know, if you just open the cage and reach in, the snakes have what we call feeding response, and almost, you know, even the non-venomous ones will just strike you because they think they're being fed. But so sometimes on the big ones, at least, we'll just use a hook, bring them over, and then they know, oh, I'm being handled, and then we grab them and there's no issue. But so are they just grabbing them, or are they using hooks initially?
They're grabbing them, no hooks. I've never seen a hook in church. So what they do is they open the snake boxes. There's sort of like a 1 foot by 1 foot like area, and they tend to grab the snake by the belly. And so the snake is kind of dangling down like a piece of spaghetti. So the head is down and the tail is down, and they have it by the stomach, if you can call it the stomach. And so the snake, I think that kind of discombobulates the snake from what I'm no expert, obviously, but the snake, if the snake's head is hanging down, and so then they'll hold it, holding it by the midsection, they'll kind of swing it back and forth often. Like they'll be walking around the stage swinging this reptile. So, and then they might grab it and kind of hold it up as the snake is sort of weaving upward. But they're never down from the snake. They're never like, they don't put the snake above them, which is quite dangerous. If I know anything about snakes, they're not like downhill for the snake. They're always kind of up. To answer your question, now they'll use hooks and things like that when they're feeding the snakes. In fact, they're very, very careful when feeding, because they don't assume that God's anointing is on them at that point. But if God's anointing them, they can basically do whatever they want, and the snake will just be docile, you know, not do much. And for the most part, the snakes are not like thrashing around unless they're newly caught.
Yeah.
They're pretty quiet, actually, most of them I've seen.
And, you know, in watching some of these videos, you know, and you really talked about this, but, you know, the people are handling the serpent, and they have, and they're kind of doing this, in my mind, what seems like a kind of a distinctive dance, and like a lot of almost like, seems like there's a lot of maybe like chanting. I mean, what's the significance of those activities relative to the snake handling?
The chanting, I mean, usually they might be singing to the music, or they're praying in tongues or something. It's all part of the worship. Although usually it's so loud when all this is going on, it's kind of hard to hear what exactly folks are doing. But every once in a while, you'll see a preacher will be preaching with a snake in his hand. And, you know, he'll be preaching or bringing home some kind of verse. But to them, this is like stark obedience to God. I mean, these people are on the edges. This is a religion of the edges. I mean, these folks are like the ultra radicals. They're putting their lives on the line. They don't know if they're going to come home that Sunday. You never know what might bite them, and they might not make it home. Because one thing I do want to say is, like, if they get bit, especially the older ones, they do not believe in going to a hospital at all. I mean, either God heals them of the bite and however much venom might have gotten sunk into them, or they will die. It's their time to go. So there's quite a, shall we say, sort of an electricity in a lot of these services. Again, I wouldn't call it chanting, but there's like this, hey, we're putting our lives on the line for God, to get God's power. And in a way, they are.
And how would the serpent handling an event like that? So you have this electrified event, you've got the music and the snakes are being passed and dancing and, you know, praying in tongues and all of this happening in this really, you know, again, as you mentioned, kind of this electrified event. How does it all kind of wind down? Is it a formal thing where when you take out the snakes, there's certain prayers that need to be said and then it ends? Or is this just something that kind of goes on for a while and then just kind of eventually slows and people put the snakes away?
I'd say most of the time snakes are handled, no more than 10 minutes goes by. And then you'll see people kind of slide over to the snake boxes and put the snake back in. They have admitted that, yeah, taking one out of the box is the most dangerous time. And they all know that. So they, you know, they're not stupid. They try to kind of slowly do it. And again, if you hold the snake by the midsection and it's dangling down, it's might not strike you. So they only will pick up snakes when they feel God's anointing. There's like a feeling that they can't describe very well, but they'll say, God is just telling me to pick up the snake. Or someone will hand a snake to them and they take it. And then they kind of, they dance in place for a few seconds and then they hand it back, which is what most of the women do. The women aren't usually slinging them around and picking them out of boxes. The women will hold them very briefly. That said, though, I've seen pregnant women holding snakes, and there is, you know, pregnant women who have been bit have been known to die, and their unborn child go with them. So, anyway, so I'd say, yeah, after about 10 minutes or so, snakes are back in the boxes, and someone will start to preach, or they'll halt the service and have time for prayer or an altar call. So the service does, it's just all part of the flow. It's not like the main part of the service. And it depends on where you are as to when in the service the snakes are brought out. Sometimes you have to wait for an hour or two until they bring out the snakes. Sometimes they'll have snake boxes up there and no one goes and gets a snake. It kind of depends on what they feel God is telling them to do.
Gotcha. And so I do think that's an important point you're making, because a lot of people from the outside who know very little about these serpent handling churches, like myself, it's that one event that stands out to everybody. And I think it's an important point to realize that, you know, there's probably much more to, you know, an event that they might have than just this aspect of it. Along those lines, and relating back to the passage that you read not too long ago, there's also some words about, I can't remember how it's termed, but like drinking, is it poisons or something? But I know that a lot of these sermons will include drinking liquids like strychnine. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit. How common is that? And just what did you learn about that aspect in your research?
It's very common. When you go to a service like this, usually there'll be a mason jar. I don't know why mason jar, but a mason jar on the podium that has strychnine powder and it, you know, somewhat filled up with water, and people come up and will take a swig out of it. And most people don't die from that. They'll say they feel really sick, but they don't die. And so maybe there isn't much strychnine in there. People have died of strychnine poisoning during services, but that was more back in the early days, more in the 40s and 50s, which is when states started outlawing all these practices because people were dying at these services. That's when you saw all the state laws. But some serpent handlers feel like strychnine is kind of boring and it's harder to get a hold of these days. So they'll do battery acid. They'll drink any kind of poison they can get their hands on. Although one person drank something and it took out his vocal cords. So, I mean, yeah. So you just, again, they believe that God is supposed to protect them. And I did look into how many snake bite deaths there had been and poison deaths of about 100 deaths from such services over about a century. There's about 10 from strychnine poisoning and about 90 or so from snake bite. So by far, it's snake bite that's killing off people. Strychnine, I don't think there's been a strychnine death in decades.
Oh, okay. And so would the drinking of poison, or what sounds like most commonly strychnine, would that almost always be part of the same service in a serpent handling? It's just kind of goes hand in hand. They're just different points within the same, or are they, can they sometimes be done individually in given service?
No, it's you'll see the whole range. So when you see the signs, like the five or so signs, they're not really like when it starts out with casting out devils, you're not really doing that, but they are speaking in tongues. They're taking up serpents. They're drinking poison. And it says they'll lay hands on the sick. There's always a time in the service where they ask people to come up for healing and they put hands on them and pray for healing. So they're usually doing four out of the five signs in any given service. And yeah, you get the whole thing. This drinking of poison isn't really, it's not a formal thing. Someone will just sort of walk up to the pulpit and, you know, take a drink. But it's not like they're watching people do it. One interesting addition to these services that is not listed in Mark 16 is what they call handling fire. Is they'll get like some kind of wick dipped in oil and they'll kind of light like this sort of informal torch. Like they put it in a Coke bottle and pass it around and then they kind of apply it to their skin. And that is quite common. And that's kind of a custom that sort of sprang up early on. That it's kind of part of the canon, but it's not listed in the Bible at all. But I've seen people put flames to their feet, and I've never seen anyone get burned from these sessions.
So I have to ask you this, and I'm sure you've been asked this, not necessarily in practicing religion, but in your research, did you ever feel the need, or did you ever try any of these activities just to see what it would be like?
Oh no. Oh my goodness. No. And God, I'm afraid of snakes. And there was a book that came out in 1995 and the author about another reporter who went and discovered snake handling, a guy called Dennis Covington. And at the end of the book, he does pick up a snake, but there's just no way. It just creeps me out. And I don't have that kind of trust that it wouldn't bite me.
Yeah.
And so, no, never done it.
Well, someday maybe when we meet in person, I can let you hold a rattlesnake in a very safe and controlled way. So you can actually.
Thank you. Yes. Show me how to do it.
Anyway, so I do want to get into the book, but last kind of more general question. So we talked about this geography to, you know, this practice. And I know that it links to particular religions, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I know it's oftentimes Pentecostal, which is a version it's a Protestant Christian religion. And then I've read about some others, like I want to say one called Holiness, and maybe another religion that are all kind of similar. So it's in certain religions and it's in a certain geographic region. So do you just, I mean, not to get in any depth, but just in a general sense, do you know where this literal interpretation of this passage came about and how it ended up in this particular region?
I just wanted to take a break and tell you guys, if you care about snakes, wildlife, or wild places, and you like what you're hearing on this podcast, go to www.orian.org now to make a difference.
The whole custom of serpent handling started in 1909 with a Pentecostal preacher called George Hensley, who was in the Chattanooga area. And it spread pretty quickly. Pentecostalism had just really begun back in 1900, about 9 or so years before. But this was a group of people who, unlike other Pentecostals, took a whole different look at Mark 16 and decided that they were supposed to be handling snakes. They're also known as Holiness Pentecostals because they believe in living very holy Circumscribed Lives. They're all the same group, and it is a subset of Pentecostals. There's no really other Protestant or Catholic group that does this sort of thing.
Okay, great. Well, I want to transition, and we'll kind of spend the rest of the podcast talking about the book. So Julia's written just really a great book that I would encourage anybody to read if you're interested in this topic. I found it very informative. I learned quite a bit. And it's called In the House of the Serpent Handler. And I will just key you in that if you're looking for the book, her name is Julia Dean, her last name is spelled D-U-I-N. But anyways, with the title of the book, you should be able to find it, and we'll have that certainly in the show notes. So, we've talked a little bit about the history in terms of how you came to researching and writing about serpent handlers in Appalachia. But let's talk specifically about the book. What was the idea? When did you decide, I'm going to go beyond writing these articles that have done so well, and I think, this topic really deserves an in-depth look?
I really decided to do it in the spring of 2013, and I was talking with Ralph Hood, who is one of the major scholars out of University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, who's really the best scholar in the world on this kind of thing. And he said, okay, if you're thinking of doing a book on this, then you need to visit some major serpent handling churches. And that's when I started driving around Appalachia to Jimmy Morrow's church near Knoxville, to the, oh my goodness, there's churches in Marshall, North Carolina, and there's one in Northeast Alabama. And I went and visited them. And they just happened to be having something called homecomings. It's like an annual gathering of serpent handlers from all over the area. They all descend on certain churches and have big feasts afterwards. And that's where I could do interviews and talk to people and ask for permission to come to their churches. So it was that summer that I got to know a lot of these folks. Meanwhile, I was also doing a lot of reporting on two major characters. One was called Andrew Hamlin. He was the 20-year-old pastor I mentioned before, and his mentor, Jamie Coots, who was a 42-year-old man out of Middlesboro, Kentucky. And they were having quite the time because they were in a reality show that aired in 2013 as well. So what I did is the focus of my book was to be on how these folks not only were serpent handlers, because that had been covered in previous books, but how they express their faith on social media. So I started tracking what they were doing on social media, which was extensive.
Yeah, I found that just to be a fascinating part of the book. But let's dive into a couple of these characters. I shouldn't call them characters, but because they are real people in your book. But let's dive into a couple of these people's stories. And if we have time, I'd like to come back and talk about Mac, but why don't we talk a little bit about Jamie and Andrew? Why don't we start with Jamie? And I think you mentioned it, or maybe you didn't, but he ultimately, died because of serpent handling. So just tell us a little bit about Jamie. First of all, who was he? Where did he live? And, what do you know about how he ended up getting into this and his, belief system around serpent handling and kind of his history in this space?
Serpent handling is usually based out of major families that have been in the tradition for many decades. And there's several families, one of which is the Coots family, C-O-O-T-S, and they tend to be based in southeastern Kentucky. A well-known pastor in the movement was Jamie Coots, and he was one of the co-stars in the reality show Snake Salvation that National Geographic broadcast in fall of 2013. His co-star was Andrew Hamlin, who Jamie was mentoring. And he was also someone who Mac knew about, Mac Wolford. And Andrew was kind of the lead character, that I followed throughout the book because he had a very dramatic story that just never stopped. I mean, he, it was just one thing after another. And so I made him the center of my book.
We can talk about Andrew a little bit if you prefer, and that might be probably a better way to do it because he is so prominent in the book. And with Andrew, I guess tell us a little bit about what you know in terms of how he really rose to prominence in the serpent handling world, and you know, to the point where, as you mentioned, he was, you know, ended up being on a television show on National Geographic.
Well, what got him there was my Wall Street Journal article that ran in April 2012. What I didn't know is all these reality TV shows were contacting him after that. In fact, he contacted me and said, you know, what should I do? What kind of contract should I sign? And whatever. And I didn't know what reality TV shows paid people. And it turned out, I think, it sounds like he was kind of underpaid because, I mean, he said he got $5,000 per episode, but he had to split it among various friends and other people who were also on the show with him. So I offered him the use of an agent friend in Los Angeles who could have gotten a much better deal, but Andrew didn't do that, which much to his regret, I think, because he could have done better. But anyway, so National Geographic showed up and started filming him. And what was so attractive is he was so young, because people are used to seeing kind of older guys do serpent handling. They hadn't seen millennials actually doing it. And Andrew's church had mostly 20-somethings. And that fascinated me. Some were out of the drug culture. Some were just totally unconverted people who just happened to be hanging out. But Andrew tended to really get a lot of people who were kind of in the non-believer status. He had them handling snakes and he had them baptized and he was really evangelizing. And he was not from a serpent handling family like the Coots were. So he was so new and he was so fresh and different. That's why I think people wanted to interview him. And it wasn't just National Geographic. There were folks from Europe showing up, documentaries. Every time I showed up at Andrew's church, which was several times a year, there was always some sort of TV show from Great Britain or France running around following him. He was just a fascinating person, very articulate, very smart, very attractive, had a wife with 6 kids. And I mean, the wife handled snakes too. And I mean, what he was training his little kids to someday handle, what was not to like? He was incredibly buoyant and amazing to all these journalists.
Yeah. Very charismatic guy, sounds like it. So interesting thing about Andrew is, as you mentioned, is that, you know, he doesn't have this family history in the snake handling. So do you know what the origin of his interest? And what I'm kind of wondering is, like myself and many other people out there who handle snakes for non-religious reasons, if he always had an interest in handling the snakes, or was it truly the religion that brought him to the snake handling?
I mean, he'd been part of the religion. He'd been part of a Pentecostal church for some time. So he was familiar with that, but he kind of wanted to go to the radical edges. And then he found Jamie, who agreed to mentor him. But no, his family wasn't into this stuff at all. Mm-hmm. And although the name Hamblin is fairly common in Appalachia, but not doing that, he kind of came in out of the blue and just asked to kind of be accepted. And so kind of the older guys were happy to mentor him. I think his grandfather was really involved in bringing him up. But anyway, Andrew started hanging out at these churches, mainly Jamie's. And then he decided to start his own church in La Follette, Tennessee, which is, there wasn't really a snake handling church super close to that. The nearest one was in Morristown, but Andrew decided to do something different. He would be open to the media. And so he started posting videos and photos of him handling snakes on Facebook, which is a very millennial thing to do. Mm-hmm. The older guys were they were shocked. They were like, what are you doing? This is a secret thing. We don't let unbelievers see this kind of stuff. But Andrew was on Facebook. That's what set him apart.
Do you think that, you know, him with a social media presence. And I can imagine that this activity ended up with quite a following. I mean, from people who might, you know, ultimately be interested in the religious aspect of it, or just people following him that are interested in, you know, in the content he was putting together. But do you think that this approach to kind of advertising the religion was increasing the rate at which it was growing, or affecting, you know, kind of the direction of serpent handling in any way?
He wasn't getting a lot of new snake handlers out of it. He reached 5,000 friends on Facebook very fast.
I bet.
But what it did, and this is some of the research I did from the University of Memphis, is that he increased acceptance of the practice, whereas most people are revolted by it. But after watching the reality show, they grew much more accepting and much more into, well, it's a religious freedom thing. He should have the right to do it. So I would say he at least got more of a tolerance from the American public on serpent handling, and that it wasn't a cruel thing, it wasn't a crazy thing, that it was actually a legitimate religious expression.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that, you know, the Snake Salvation, the National Geographic show, also kind of did the same, kind of made this, you know, more of a mainstream type practice that people would look at and be entertained by, if you will.
Absolutely. And the hope of all these handlers is that they could spread the practice beyond Appalachia. Before he died, Mac Wolford had told me that he'd heard of people in Texas who wanted to know about it. They'd felt God telling them to pick up a snake, but they needed some mentoring. So the dream has always been to spread it across the country and not just restrict it to these eastern mountainous states. Unfortunately, it just hasn't happened. As of now, it hasn't happened mainly because of some kind of bad PR on deaths in the movement.
Yeah. Interesting. So tell me a little bit about Snake Salvation. I've watched some clips, but, you know, for people who are interested and want to go watch it and learn more, I mean, what can they expect to see? How is the show structured? And, you know, I know that Jamie and Andrew played prominent roles in it, you know, but what's that show all about?
It was a 16 part series that mainly had cameras following the Coots family and the Hamblin family around. I learned later that Andrew's wife just hated it, and she was hardly on camera. So it was mainly Andrew, and I think I'll tell you the negative parts of it, in that they felt like the producers always wanted to see them doing something with snakes, feeding mice to snakes, going hunting for snakes. And Andrew said, you know, I don't go hunting for snakes all that often. It's not that big a part of my life. And so with the Coots, they were kind of ramping up sort of like some inter-family conflicts that really had nothing to do with snakes. But, you know, in reality shows, I mean, that's kind of partly what it is. It's conflict. And I think both these families weren't really prepared for the camera crew wanting them to get into arguments and get into these big fights with each other. That isn't who they were. Mm-hmm. So on the positive side, it popularized serpent handling with very human type people. I mean, of course, they're human, but their humanity was very evident. They weren't weird. They weren't strange. They weren't like eyes rolling trances. You know, they were just regular guys who had bunches of kids and who had a regular life and who drove school buses for a living and who just happened to handle snakes during their Sunday church service. And I think that's the good thing the series did is humanize the practice.
Okay. Well, I would encourage, you know, again, I'm going to go out and watch some of the episodes. I've watched a number of clips now, but I would encourage our audience to go see that if they'd like to see some of what we're talking about. And then, you know, I don't want to speak negatively about Mr. Hamblin, but it is kind of a theme through your book. You go through kind of, you know, what's happened to him through his life. And he kind of has this, on the personal side, this very interesting trajectory. You know, you know, it sounds like he lived very relatively poor. You know, he became a reality TV star, if you will, but, you know, probably didn't get all the funds he should out of that. You know, he had other interesting things like a house, somebody buy him a house when he became somewhat famous. And then he had a whole series of events on his personal life that kind of fell apart. I was wondering, again, normally I wouldn't want to dive into this, but it is in the book. I mean, could you just kind of like give the high level description of those major points in his life on that personal side, but then how that linked back into the religion and his serpent handling, and did it affect his, his ability to continue practicing and so on?
Let's see. After the reality show, the Tennessee wildlife people came and arrested him and ended up going into his church and taking 53 snakes out of the basement. They were all in aquaria, and they were euthanized by the Knoxville Zoo because they were in really, really bad shape. He got dragged into a trial for kind of mistreatment of animals. A grand jury let him off. And so he was pretty happy about that. And then Jamie, about 2 or 3 months later, was handling a rattlesnake during just a regular Saturday evening service, got bit. And he'd been bitten like 8 or 9 times before that. But this time was different. Jamie died and like almost like dropped dead in his tracks. And then he was dead in about 3 hours. His heart stopped. He refused medical treatment. That shook Andrew up quite a bit. He seemed to recover. With Jamie gone, Andrew's church was like the biggest, really, snake handling church going. Unfortunately, the person who he was renting his church from decided to not rent it to him anymore. And all of a sudden, he didn't have a place to practice serpent handling. And if you don't have a church and if you don't have property, you're dead in the water. Because most other churches, they're not going to rent because of insurance, because of maybe lawsuits, liability. They're not going to rent their stuff to you. His life fell apart. He and his wife ended up getting divorced. He took up with another woman. And at one point, he showed up back at his wife's place with a gun and shot some bullets into her trailer. He ended up in jail for 6 months. He got divorced, married the other woman who was pregnant with his child. And by that point, he had decided that social media had ruined him in some ways and just dropped off of Facebook. And to this day, really doesn't post on it. He is living a quieter life in Kentucky, and because he left the state and moved about 2 hours north. And he has started a new family with his new wife. His former wife tells me he never sees his 6 kids that he had with her. So as to whether he practices his religion, for sure, he has started a new church in Gray, Kentucky, which is a small town, not far from La Follette, just sort of over the state line into Kentucky. And he's going more the pastoral route. It's not so much on snakes. He feels like, you know, that just being a Christian isn't all about handling snakes. And so, but he hasn't given it up yet either, but it's just kind of a less of a thing. And so he is continuing to go on. It really didn't affect his faith, although he feels like, you know, God can really help and rescue people like him who have made mistakes. And that's what he really bases his ministry on, is that God forgives even the worst mistakes.
Interesting. What an interesting life that this young man has led. And you do such a good job of teaching us all about this in the book. So I really encourage all of our audience to go out, purchase a copy of the book. Again, it's called In the House of the Serpent Handler by Julia Dean, spelled D-U-I-N. And so if our audience did want to do that, Julia, where would they go to find this book?
Of course, you can find it on Amazon, but you can also go to the University of Tennessee Press website, and you can just type in D-U-I-N, and serpents, or in the house of the serpent handler. You'll get it from them too. If you don't really want to patronize Amazon, you can go through to UT Press, and it's still in print. And just want to say that, you know, the interest is bigger than ever. I'm still getting calls from European TV producers. And, but yeah, it's a lovely book. And I worked very hard on it. And it's a notoriously difficult group to do stories on. I got their trust at the time. But things have changed. And it's probably even harder to do a book. If someone wanted to do one, it's tough to do. So I would say get this one, because it's going to be a while before there's another book out.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you for writing it. And again, I really enjoyed it, and I hope our audience does. So, you know, I know you're not a snake person. You've already mentioned that, you know, they creep you out. But I know that you've been around snakes quite a bit. You've already told us some, you know, some of what you've seen in these services. So one thing I ask every, you know, all of our guests here on Snake Talk is to tell us their best snake story. And so I'm just curious if you have a story that you remember from spending time in Appalachia that might just be something everybody would kind of be interested in hearing.
Sure. I just want to add one more thing. If people are really interested in following this group, there is a Facebook group called Serpent Handlers. And so whether or not they'll let you in is another thing, but they might. They might, even if you're not Pentecostal or don't follow the beliefs. But I'm just saying, folks listening to this broadcast tend to be really interested in snakes. So if you really want to, if you're interested in these people, you can get some access into this group. And just say, you know, you're a researcher and you're interested and you just like to listen in. Okay, as far as my snake story, I would say the most meaningful one is when I was down in Alabama, and I had known that there was a very famous serpent handler. His name is Punkin, like P-U-N-K-I-N. That was his nickname. And he and his wife had both died handling serpents. And I'd always wondered what had happened to their five kids. So I was at a service, and in walked what looked like a 21 or 22-year-old. Well, actually, they were two guys. They were twins. And one was preaching, the other was handling snakes. And I, all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, these are Punkin's kids. And that you think, you know, if you're both of your parents died serpent handling in different services, the last thing you'd be doing is handling snakes. But nope. This couple's kids, I think all five of them ended up handling snakes, even though, considering what their family went through, it's the Brown family. And again, another traditional serpent handling family. And I just remember just sitting there thinking, Punkin died 5 feet away from where I am, and there are his sons handling snakes. And I don't even know what to make of that. But somewhere it might make sense somewhere someday.
Wow, that's fascinating. You've certainly had quite a journey around our Appalachian region here, and seeing things that very few people get to see. So, I appreciate you coming on and sharing that story. So, if people, we've talked about where they can find the book, but if people wanted to learn more about you and some of the other work you've done, or follow you, you know, are you very active on social media, or is there anywhere people can go to learn more about you?
Sure. I'm under Julia Dean in Facebook and in Twitter. There's not too many people with the last name of D-U-I-N. And by the way, if you want to visit some of these churches, the book has driving descriptions on how to get to six of these churches and when their service times are. So you can go see them. And again, they're scattered all over the place, and it's possible to go see it for yourself. And I'm always glad to answer questions if people message me on Facebook. I tend to know who's open, what churches are operating and functioning these days, and which ones aren't. I do keep up with that sort of thing.
Well, Julia, thank you so much for spending some time with us here at Snake Talk. It's truly been a pleasure. I want to also thank our audience and tell everybody to remember, snakes are animals too, and it's a privilege to see one in the wild.